This is Dan Austin in the home of Mr. and Mrs. Bob Turley in Naples, Florida. The date is Thursday, January the 28th, 1992. This interview is the property of the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Mr. Turley has graciously consented to be interviewed and for this to be part of the archives of the Baseball Hall of Fame. Bob, as we have talked a few moments, I want to thank you again for the privilege of being invited to your home. And I have, before we began, we talked a little bit about baseball and about where you grew up. But for the record, if you'd give your date of birth, place of birth, and from that, a little bit maybe about your parents. Somebody had an influence in your going into baseball, I'm sure.
Dan, I was originally born in Troy, Illinois on September the 19th, 1930. Didn't live in Troy very long. In fact, I just lived there for about two or three months. Then we moved to East St. Louis, Illinois, where I was truly raised, was in East St. Louis, Illinois. My father was not athletically inclined during the World War II. He was in the service right in the prime years when I would be not even a teenager at that point playing baseball. But he was the type of a father that enjoyed being with the kids, and we did a lot of things together. But I grew up in a neighborhood where all the kids on the street, there wasn't no such thing as Little League baseball, so we got together in lots and schoolyards and played sports. And when football was in, we played football. When basketball season, we played basketball, baseball, so on. And we loved to play, just played for the enjoyment, because there was no television. You weren't allowed to stay in the house. When I grew up, when they made you stay in the house, you would be penalized. Today, when you go, you're being penalized, children today, by making you go outside the house.
Yeah, it's East St. Louis, it reminds me of also the hometown of Hank Bauer. Now,
yes.
Of course, he's a little bit older than you are.
Yes.
But
there was some pretty good athletes, a couple you might remember. Of course, Hank came from there. Hank had an older brother who was a tremendous ball player. Probably was a little bit better than Hank, but got killed in the war, World War II. Mm-hmm. And then Johnny Rawalski came from there. Hoot Evers came from there. Another pitcher by the name of Walker, he used to pitch for the St. Louis Cardinals, he came from there. So it was quite a few. It was a good, hard-working town. It wasn't mostly laborers and people like that came out of East St. Louis. So they were sports-minded. They were the ones that sit in the bar and drink and yell when the Cardinals or the Browns were playing ball. And there was always something going on in the sports arena.
So you played a lot of makeup scrub games?
Played a lot of that. A lot of we have our own little team we'd play, and then we went to the church. The church had their own baseball team. We traveled around, and then about 1942 or 43, they started a chamber of commerce, a junior chamber of commerce, Little League baseball. It wasn't called Little League, but they had it in age brackets from 10 years of age was the youngest you could get in, 10 to 12 was the B League, and then from 12 to about 14 was the A League, and I started playing in that.
You were a big kid then, kind of strapping, bigger than most kids?
Right. I was bigger than the average size a boy, and could throw the baseball real hard, and so baseball was just something that I enjoyed throwing and striking out people, so it was fun.
The batters didn't dig their feet in when you came up to the mound.
No, yeah, I remember. I'm the only one that was outlawed from pitching when I was 12 years old. I was in the B League, which is the youngsters, and I threw so hard that they outlawed me, and I couldn't pitch the following year. I had to play the outfield. So one year in my little career, I couldn't pitch. They said because the boys were maturing too much, and they had too many younger kids in there, so they. Yeah, they didn't allow me to pitch.
Yeah. I remember when I played in Kansas City, we called it 3-2 league. This was in right after the war. There was a fellow I played in high school against, Bob Hayes' name, and had terrible control, but he scared the devil out of us. I mean, we'd swing at anything, whether it was up against our eyeballs or behind our back, just to get out of there.
Right.
So I can believe that they said, Turley, you go out there in left field and stay there for this season. Yeah.
I remember me talking about that. I remember throwing a ball, and I hit a little boy. It didn't hurt him. I just hit him on the arm or something like that. And his mother raced out of the mound with a purse and was hitting me with a purse.
Well, as a Little League manager, I didn't see quite that, but I saw something, those umbilical cords stretch a long way from from the grandstand out there on the field.
Sure do.
You loved the game, and evidently you had quite a bit of ability, and you played it in high school.
Yes.
And evidently some scouts saw you across the river.
You know, I was talking about high school. I love to play sports. I didn't want to be a spectator. I want to be a participant. Mm-hmm. And I remember I had an uncle named Ralph, and there's a story added to this later on we'll add back in. But Ralph was pitching on a high school team, and he was 2 years older than I was. Mm-hmm. And so when I came into high school, I went out for the high mm-hmm. school baseball team. They had a coach by the name of Pick Daner, who was a pretty good basketball coach, and the baseball coach too. And Pick, I went out and tried out for the team, and he liked me, but mm-hmm. he wanted me to stay around, didn't give me a uniform, and of course that was an insult, but he wanted me to throw batting practice and be on the team, but mm-hmm. not play, because okay. he had too many returning seniors on the team, and most of those seniors were his basketball team.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't say nothing, but I didn't show up for practice no more, and I didn't come out for the team. And that summer, I was pitching in the Muni League. Now, keep in mind, I was I was still just a freshman in high school, but mm-hmm. I was pitching in the Muni League. That was for the kids that are out of high school, and I was a star pitcher in the Muni League. Mm-hmm. And he was the umpire, and he kept asking me all the time to come back out for the team, and I would not come back out. I said, I went out once, and I'm going to sit around. So I didn't come back out for baseball until my senior year when he kind of begged me to come out for the team. Mm-hmm. And so then I went out for the team, of course, and I pitched only my senior year in high school. Only because the coach didn't want to play me, and I just didn't want to sit on a bench.
You weren't about to sit on a bench?
No, it wasn't no fun to sit on a bench yeah. and watch a game. Mm-hmm. I want to go play it.
Well, evidently some scouts saw you your senior year of high school.
Yes, they did. What happened to me is that two things during my senior year, a guy by the name of Howard Dart,
mm-hmm.
and he was a kind of a bird dog, they call him. I guess mm-hmm. he still got him today for the
yeah.
St. Louis Browns.
Yeah.
And they asked him to make arrangements with high school coach to pick the top three senior baseball players and bring them over to this St. Louis Browns tryout. So I went over there with them, and of course they couldn't sign me because I was still in my high
mm-hmm.
school. But at the same time, the Yankees were having a tryout in Maryville, Illinois, which is just a little town right outside of St. Louis. And I went up there for the tryout, along with my Uncle Ralph. And
mm-hmm.
so we both went up there for a tryout, and I pitched and he pitched, and we both did exceptionally
mm-hmm.
well. At the time then, my mother had divorced my father, and so the name of the phone book was Hale, and it wasn't Turley. And so my Uncle Ralph was living with his dad, which
mm-hmm.
was my grandfather, was Turley.
Mm-hmm.
So the Yankees decided that they wanted to sign me. Well, what they did is that, you know, we put down addresses and
mm-hmm.
everything, but they called, somehow they sent a scout out
mm-hmm.
and called up my grandfather and said, this is a Turley, went to the trial
yeah.
camp. He says, yes.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, I'd like to sign you. So the same night that I graduated from high school, and I had a Browns scout out to my
mm-hmm.
house by the name of Ed Kurobon, signing me up. The same night they had a Yankee scout,
mm-hmm.
it was with my grandfather,
right.
and he thought he was signing my uncle up. Signing me up, but he signed my uncle Ralph. And so then we both went to a Class D league, Illinois
mm-hmm.
State League. He went to Marion in the league, which
mm-hmm.
was a Yankee farm
mm-hmm.
club. And I went to Belleville, which was the Browns
mm-hmm.
farm. I remember coming down to Marion, and I was going to pitch that night. And I pitched that
mm-hmm.
night and beat his club. And when the game was
mm-hmm.
over, Ralph and I went over to his clubhouse, and we was going out and get something to eat. And he had his bags all packed. And I said, well, what's the matter? He said, well, they told me they signed the wrong Turley. So he got released that night.
He got a release.
Yeah, he played a couple of years later
mm-hmm.
on, but he didn't really materialize anything. And it's a true story. A guy, Maguala, was a head
mm-hmm.
scout in
mm-hmm.
that area. Lou
mm-hmm.
Maguala was a head scout. He's passed on
mm-hmm.
now, but for the Yankees, and he admitted
that he admitted later
they
that they signed the wrong one. And
right.
Well, they got you back later.
Right.
Let's
put
it that way.
Trade later on.
St. Louis Browns. There's an old saying that it's first in shoes, the old Brown Shoe Company,
right.
first in booze, and last in the American League.
No question about that. I, you know, of course, being growing up in East St. Louis and being a great fan, I was
mm-hmm.
a great fan of the St. Louis Cardinals,
mm-hmm.
and I remember going all over all the time. Didn't go to many of the Browns games. I went a lot of the games with the Cardinals. But
at the old Sportsman's
Park? Old Sportsman's Park out there on
mm-hmm.
Grand Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to a lot of the games. So the Browns just never could draw enough people to make enough money because
mm-hmm.
You didn't have TV rights or
mm-hmm.
radio rights
mm-hmm.
and all that kind of stuff. So it had to come from fans.
Yeah.
And they always had to trade away their stars all the
mm-hmm.
time just to keep the franchises
mm-hmm.
alive. And I kind of fell on that same pattern with
mm-hmm.
them, too. And But they had a lot of great ball players that played pretty good major league baseball.
You bet. Oh, Ned Garber in the late 40s, sure. I think he won 20 games for them and probably won half of the games of the entire team, the entire pitching staff.
Sure did, yeah.
And in fact, I read where in 1936, the Browns drew a total attendance that year of 80,000.
It wouldn't surprise me. I remember one ball game that when I was with the Browns, it was a doubleheader. Mm-hmm. And they played a ball game, and then it was a single game, but we played the Harlem Globetrotters, a basketball game. They put a wooden floor down between third and second, and we played the Harlem Globetrotters, and there must have been 18,000 people in the stands. And then they had it. Shoot.
Okay.
We played the Harlem Globetrotters. And 18,000 people in the stands, and when the game was over, they cleared up all the stuff on the basketball court. And when we started our game, there wasn't 1,500 people in the stands to see the major league game. They all left. So that shows you how popular we were.
And the St. Louis Browns played, the ball players played the Harlem Globetrotters in an exhibition basketball game.
We sure did, yes. Uh-huh.
What did Will Herridge think about that? Now, this was when Bill Vick was owner of the club?
Bill Vick had the ball club at that time.
Uh-huh. Well, you never knew what he was.
No, he always, that's when the midget and all those things took place.
Uh-huh. Fun and Games was his.
That's right.
I could imagine Will Herridge became livid about the St. Louis Browns playing the Harlem Globetrotters when a major league ball game was to have been played.
That's right. He didn't, of course, Vick did so many things. I think he got the ire of everybody.
Bill Vick, of course, he just three years ago put into the Hall of Fame, which, 35 years ago, you'd never thought would have happened.
No.
But quite an innovator, renegade.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that he had his apartment in the below the grandstand of Sportsman's Park.
I don't recall that, but he probably did. He had everything else. But one thing that Bill Vick had, he had a love of the game. I don't think that he would ever do anything
that superseded, all the showmanship?
Yeah. I think the showmanship was his way. But when the game started and played, that was an entirely different thing. And he was a showman to try to pack people in. Because if Bill Vick would have ever had a decent ball club, maybe he would have not have done as much. But he never had a decent ball club that he owned. I guess Cleveland Indians would have been the closest. Mm-hmm. But when he took over them, they were not a good ball club.
That's right. Were you on, they say, one of the most memorable games in Major League history was in 1951 when the Browns played the Detroit Tigers with the midget. Eddie Gaydel
something
like that?
With a G, yes.
Were you on that team at that time?
I was on that team later on. That was 1951 or 53. I can't remember. I think it was
51.
I was in the minor leagues and came to the ball club at the close of the season.
Okay.
Because they always.
So you weren't there for that.
I wasn't there
game.
When that game took place. No.
Okay. Going back then to your minor leagues, then you were with this Class D. Of course, they don't have Class D anymore.
No.
What kind of record did you have when you started out there after your uncle was released?
I'll tell you, we had a ball club in 1948, and of course Belleville was just 20 miles from St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And Browns had a lot of tryout camps going all along the time. They would sign a ball player, bring him into Belleville, and he'd pitch or play a couple of games. Didn't do too well, they'd release him. So we had 98 ball players in and out on that ball club. 98 total ball players that came and left. You can only keep... I think you only keep 18 ball players on a team, but that's how many trading kept going on.
Well, they really recycled.
They really did, and it was a manager's nightmare trying to build a ball club in that type of a situation. And I remember I joined the ball club right out of high school, 17 years of age, and went up and joined the ball club, and the manager didn't know me from Matt or from Eve, and he gave me a uniform, and I'm the youngest guy there. Most of the guys are older than I am at that time. And so I didn't play. I just would bat and practice and run every night. And that's all I did. And really had no coaching, no nothing going on. And all of a sudden, Jack Farnier, who was the head coach, head minor league, in charge of the minor leagues, or scout for the Browns, he came over, and Bill DeWitt came over. He was the owner of the Browns, and they wanted to see me pitch. Mm-hmm. And so that night I had thrown 30 minutes of batting practice. I was out in the outfield running, and the manager, when they came in, called me out and says, "You're pitching tonight." So it didn't bother me, and what the heck? I mean, 17 years of age.
That's right.
And I pitched against Wes Frankfurt, which Earl Weaver was the shortstop on that ball club at that time. And I beat him 3-2 that night and struck out 12 guys. And I think I pitched a three-hitter in my first professional game. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't think nothing about it. And they had a habit when after you won your game, then they'd put you on what they call a three-day disabled list so they could bring another ball player in, and you would stay at home, and they'd go on a road trip. So I went up to the coach and said, well, am I staying home? He said, what do you mean staying home? You're part of the team. So that's where they got more ball players by using the rules.
Did they use a disabled list and just kept them at home? And
that's right. They'd have maybe, you might have 20 or 30 ball players on the roster. They had so many sitting on a disabled list. Now, they weren't paying us any money. I made $200 a month. And we got $1.75 a day for meal money when it was on the road.
Yeah. When you got on the bus and took off and or a train or something like that and on your way somewhere else.
No trains. We had a bus.
You had a bus.
It wasn't a Greyhound. It was a school bus.
And the manager probably drove it.
That's right. That's exactly who drove it.
As a kid, you know, 17 years old, you got a lot of World War II veterans that are trying to get back in baseball. They didn't give a shine for whether you made it or not. You just kind of isolated.
That's right.
You didn't get many tips from them
because
you might get their job.
100%. I never got no help from nobody to talk about pitching, no nothing. And I think one of the things that amazed me is, you know, you're in awe as a youngster growing up. And I remember the first guy, I don't remember his name, but I remember the first guy I pitched on that West Frankfort team. And I threw three pitches and struck him out. I said, well, these guys ain't no good at all. And so it built up my confidence.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And that year I ended up with a record of 9-3. And, of course, I didn't join the ball club until June, I think June the 15th. Mm-hmm. And the season was over on August the 15th. So I was 9-3 in that short period of time.
Mm-hmm. So here you are, teenager. Making $200, hey, that's not too bad money.
That was good money.
You bet.
That's 200 a month.
That's 200 a month.
Yeah.
That is just during the season.
Right.
Come back home, and what did your folks say?
Well,
get out of it, or did they really say?
Oh, no. My folks were very proud of that, just to be a professional athlete, you know, for somebody to have a little success.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that was 1948, and season was over, and I had to go get a job, and I went to work for Swift Packing Company, and I used to bone hams and clean pigtails, and I used to save up enough money in the winter. I'd save up $1,000, because I was making $200 a week boning hams, but I was making $200 a month playing baseball, but I love baseball. So I'd save up about $1,000, and then I could go to spring training the next year. And so next year I went down to Pine Bluff, Arkansas. That's where they brought all their minor league teams in. And it was an old Air Force base in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And in the summertime, they grew corn all over. But in the wintertime, they'd plow it all up. And there was 500 ball players from Class A down. That's how many ball players were down there. And we ate in a barrack. We ate in a mess hall because it was just an Air Force base. And we all slept in a regular barracks with high and low beds on the bunk beds and things like that. And I remember that they used to take us out in the field every morning and line up 500 ball players, and it was an impressive sight to see, and we'd walk across this field, and we'd pick up corn stalks and dirt and rocks and everything else and dump it on that side, and then we'd come back again and do the same thing, dump it on this side. Somebody would pick it all up. Then they took the bases and put down the bases and made four diamonds, and that was the four diamonds that we played, we practiced on.
Isn't that kind of intimidating, you know, with the 500 ball players all after, and here you are 17, 18 years old? You think, hey, do I have a ghost of a chance?
Well, yes, because you would listen to guys talk. I mean, I was with Aberdeen, South Dakota, as a contract. It was a Class C league, and Irv Hall was the manager, and I hear all these guys talk and listen to all this stuff, you know, and they're worried, am I going to make the team? And I didn't know what they were even talking about because I had a contract with the club, and I figured I was going to go play baseball with them.
Didn't get intimidated by all those war stories?
I didn't. I guess I was maybe too stupid or too dumb or just too naive or whatever you want, and so I just went about my job, and I just went and played baseball, pitched. I never had nobody help me and tell me what to pitch with, what to do, or... And so then the club camp broke up, and you had your ball players, and we got in a bus and drove north and played a couple exhibition games against some other minor league teams on the way up north and went up to Aberdeen, South Dakota, started playing baseball. And I'd won my, won 18 straight games without a defeat over a two-year period of time. I won my last six straight in a row with the ball club in Belleville. And I won my first 12. I was 12 and 0. So I won 18 straight games. And in Aberdeen, I kind of set a record that nobody can beat.
Mm-hmm.
You can tie it. Mm-hmm. But every game I started, I finished. And every game I relieved, I finished. And I was 23 and 5 was my record for the year. And I hit 310 as a hitter. Now, I'm talking about never being taken out of a game. Every game I went in, I finished.
That's unheard of.
Yeah. You don't
even in those days.
No, you don't see it. I pitched.
You were an old workhorse.
Yeah, they just give me the baseball. I just love to pitch. I never get tired. I just kept on pitching all
You must
time.
Have had a good leg, used your legs a lot.
Strong.
So that you didn't have to use simply your upper body.
No, if you ever watch my pitching style, I had to stop Robin Roberts and I pitched an awful lot below the waist down.
Mm-hmm.
Because we both, when we threw, we got our bodies down and shoved up the mound real hard. And mm-hmm.
Used your legs and all
right,
that.
Right, I used to have to wear pads on my knees because my knees would grab the ground. So I did that.
Well, you were down that low.
Yeah, down low. So if you watch Robin mm-hmm. and I, who's a good friend of mine, our styles from that point down was about the same.
That same.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you could throw all day long, work up a sweat, and be ready to start the next day.
I never had a sore arm until I had a bone chip in 1961.
Mm-hmm.
I had surgery then.
Uh-huh. So... with that spectacular record in Aberdeen, the Browns said, hey, we need this guy up here in a hurry.
Yeah. Well, when the season was over, because I'm in East St. Louis anyway, so they called mm-hmm. me up to come mm-hmm. over to the Browns, and I finished out the season. Didn't get to pitching through batting practice and everything. I remember Joe Schultz was a bullpen catcher mm-hmm. coach, and he used to warm me up, and he said, I don't understand why they don't pitch you. He says, you have better stuff than the Allen's ball club. Anyway, after that season, I remember 1950, mm-hmm. The Browns were training in Burbank, California,
mm-hmm.
and we stayed in Hollywood at the Hollywood mm-hmm. Plaza Hotel, and so it was a big to-do for me. I mean, I'd never mm-hmm. been to California and getting a train, and they had a big publicity of mm-hmm. all the Browns getting on the train, going out to spring training, mm-hmm. and I went out there, and that was really my first exposure with the Major League Ball Club, and I watched all those guys pitch, and I'd study Obermeyer, and I looked at him, and I said, gosh, I said, if he can win in the big leagues with the crap he throws, because he's a little bitty guy, mm-hmm. left-hand pitcher, and hit between the eyes, couldn't blacken an eye. And Joe Ostrowski was another left-hander just like him, mm-hmm. and there were some other pitchers, too, that had on ball club. I don't remember all the names right now. I could if I stopped and think mm-hmm. about it. But I said, there's no way they can keep me off this ball club.
Mm-hmm.
So in spring training, but in those days, clubs were pretty much set. Before you ever, I didn't have a major league contract, so clubs were always pretty much set.
Even before spring training?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they didn't really believe in those days of bringing a rookie and finding somebody in spring training and bringing a phenom up as much as you do today. They weren't quite, they were kind of closed a little bit, and based on last year's records and mm-hmm. trades and, mm-hmm. and things like that, pretty much had the clubs made. And then the managers, that's how you played in spring training. So I didn't get to pitch a lot in spring mm-hmm. training, but I pitched a few games out there. And then when the spring training broke up, they sent me to San Antonio, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't stay there too long. A guy by the name of Don Heppner.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. He was a manager. I pitched two ball games. I opened a season for him in Beaumont, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Gil McDougal was on that team. Mm-hmm. That was the Yankee organization.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think I got beat 2-1 in mm-hmm. inning. And then I pitched another game where I got beat 3-1. And that was my two games I pitched, and then he shipped me out and shipped me up to Wichita, Kansas, where I went to play ball. I never could figure it out.
Western Association, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, Wichita. And then that's where Don Larson and I got together. He was there. And I remember I flew in there and mm-hmm. landed in Lincoln, Nebraska, and just got off the plane, got to the ball game, and it was in the first inning. They just knocked the pitcher out.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy by the name of Joe Schultz come back mm-hmm. in my life again. Mm-hmm. He said, go down and warm up. So I went in the first inning of that game, and I pitched 16 innings and gave up one run, bottom of six, and I was the 16th. I was losing pitcher. And I came right back and pitched another game right after that, and mm-hmm. I got beat 1-0 in 16. I pitched 32 innings, and I was 0-2 and gave up a grand total of 2 runs. that's
fantastic ERA, but
yeah,
I tell you. Zipping too, huh?
Right. And so I played there, which was a real fun year. Schultz was the type of manager that made you all feel pretty good. And then I had, the worst year I had in mind, I can't remember what it was. I think it was either 13-11 or 11-13, something mm-hmm. like that was the record. Then the next year they sent me back to San Antonio, and I was 21-7, most valuable pitcher in the Texas League.
And that's when they brought you up.
Brought me up to the Browns, and mm-hmm. then I had, as soon as I went to the Browns, I spent about 30 days up there, something like that, and then I had to go into military service.
Oh, Korea?
Korea, and I played, stayed in Fort Sam Houston, Texas. Mm-hmm. I was at Brook Army Medical Center, and we had a good baseball team. Don Newcomb was on the ball club, mm-hmm. Dick Kokas, and there's a lot of major league ball players, mm-hmm. and we played a lot of games. And we used to beat the major league clubs when they came through. We beat the Browns. I think one day 13-2 when they came through, and then I think the White Sox beat us 2-1 in 13 innings. Mm-hmm. We had a major league team there.
So after you were released from military active duty, that's when then St. Louis was, Bill Beck really was forced to sell the franchise and off to Baltimore.
Right. 1953, I saved up all my leave time, and I went in August and came up to the big leagues. Well, I was mm-hmm. still in the military, but I was pitching for them, but I was on what you call a terminal leave time. Mm-hmm. And I took my leave, and then I had to come back and get out of the Army mm-hmm. in October. October the 12th, I believe it was. You remember those days because you'd have to get out of the military. Right. And then my wife and I went down to Puerto Rico, and I played baseball in Puerto Rico that winter. Mm-hmm. And then over the winter time of 53, that's when the Browns moved the franchise to Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And then when I come back from Puerto Rico, then I went down to Yuma, Arizona, where I had a spring training with the Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And then we came back to Baltimore, and Baltimore had a good year there, but it was just... The ball club was the same as the Browns.
That's right.
They're just different uniforms. We still lost the same amount of games. I think we lost 100 games, something like that.
But, Memorial Stadium, mm-hmm. which no longer exists. And you told me earlier that, you pitched in the first game as a Baltimore Oriole.
Right. Yeah, the baseball is on the wall over there. That's the actual winning baseball. I beat the Chicago White Sox. Pitched 9 innings, struck out 9 or 10 guys or something like that, and that was the first game it was ever played.
Yeah, right there.
In 1954.
And so you finished out the first year
in Baltimore.
They got good crowds, a lot of fanfare, much different scene than in St. Louis.
Oh, yeah, we'd never seen crowds. You know, I think we drew right at 1 million people that very first year, which was great. I mean, that first game I pitched, there was the whole thing, everything was taken, about 40-some-odd thousand people there. I'd never seen a crowd like that with the Browns. And I remember the season was over, and right before the season was over, Paul Richards came in. He was the new general manager and the manager. And Jimmy Dykes was the manager. Mm-hmm. And my record at that time was, 14 and 15, or 13 and 14. And Jimmy Dykes was going to let me pitch the last game of the year to kind of balance out the record, see if I could get 15 and 15 mm-hmm. or 14 and mm-hmm. 14. And Paul Richards called me in the office and says, "You pitch enough all year. You don't need to pitch this game." And so I didn't pitch the ball game that year. And so I remember when that day you start talking to me, he said, "Bob, what's your plans?" I said, "Well, I live in Baltimore now, and uh-huh. I have a son. Well, the son wasn't born, yeah. The baby's going to be born." Yeah. I said, "I'm going to stay here this winter." And he says, "Good." He says, "Because you're about the only thing we have on this ball club, and we're going to kind of build the ball club around you. Glad to see you doing that." Uh-huh. So the season was over, and I remember in October, latter part of October, I'm sitting at home now. My son's born. And he's in my lap, and I'm watching television. I'm watching the Steve Allen show. It was late tonight, mm-hmm. so all of a sudden my pictures flashed on the screen. Bob Turley traded to the New York Yankees. That was the first thing Paul Richards did. And
that was a big trade. There was a bunch of ball players.
I think there was something 17 or 19 ball players involved. And I remember watching that, and the guys, my heart just starts to race and think, "Here, I'm trading for the New York Yankees," because as a pitcher, I don't care how good you are, if you have a lousy defensive ball club behind you and they don't score any runs, you're not going to mount it, because there were a lot of great pitchers in the big leagues, great ability, but they played with losing ball clubs, and so they never had a winning record. And although they had as much ability as some of these guys are in the Hall of Fame today, they just weren't on the right team. That's what happened. And so I remember that night, because my phone started ringing off the hook, and everybody in Baltimore was saying, "Oh, man, aren't you so sad to be traded the New York Yankees and leaving us?" And I said to myself, "I'll crawl to New York. Just get me out of here." You know? And I remember the mm-hmm. Baltimore fans had given me a Cadillac as the most valuable player that year.
Mm-hmm.
Sponsorship through, I think, Gunther Brewing Company. And the next morning we got Dan Yankee written on my car, and kind of in the dust. Not mean, but just kind of a joke.
And, you were the mainstay in which to build a team, and all of a sudden you're going to start wearing the pinstripes.
That's right. I remember going along with that, Don Larson and I were both involved in that trade. Mm-hmm. And that year in 55, our first year with New York, mm-hmm. we were going to play the Brooklyn Dodgers, and we both sent Paul Richards a telegram thanking him for trading us.
You know, before we go to the Yankees, and I must admit my prejudice toward them, as I shared mm-hmm. with you, you played with two giants of baseball in terms of knowing the game, Jimmy Dykes and Paul Richards.
That's right.
And Paul Richards, I have always heard of as an innovator, a thinker. Mm-hmm. What did you learn from Paul Richards, aside from being traded?
First of all, I never played for him. See, he was the first thing he did. He took over the ball club and at the end of the 1954 season, and the first thing he did, first move he made as an Oriole general manager, was to trade me. So Jimmy Dykes was a manager way up to the very end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy was a very, very knowledgeable man. I think mm-hmm. he would have gone a long way in baseball, but he had the unfortunate of never being with an organization that ever had any mm-hmm. good, great ball clubs.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good ball player himself. He was fun. I kind of put him as a poor man's Casey Stengel. And he was kind of laughable, fun, mm-hmm.
yeah.
always
easygoing.
Mm-hmm. Like Casey was. Paul Richards, on the other side, as I observe him later on, because Paul and I came back into play a little bit later in my life, so mm-hmm. I'll tell you. But Paul was really astute of the game, because mm-hmm. he was a catcher. Didn't have any great ability as a hitter. He was a good defensive catcher, mm-hmm. and so his whole life has been defense. You know, he built great pitching staffs out of people that couldn't do much,
uh-huh.
but he picked these pitchers mostly with the ones that could throw strikes, and then he worked real strong with them and built good infields and outfield, uh-huh. but he never could develop a strong offensive ball club, and that's the only thing kept him from becoming a great, well-known, he's a well-known manager, mm-hmm. but I mean from a standpoint of wins and losses, he got more out of his ball players. And Paul, as time went on, lost a lot of his patience with people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think
couldn't make
players.
That transition to a new generation
yes,
of players.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I heard that when he Hoyt Wilhelm, his knuckleball, when Dempsey was the catcher
uh-huh.
after he was traded by the Yankees, that you never knew where that knuckleball was going to go.
Right.
And so there was really one baseball rule that was made as a result of a maneuver that Richards did, and that was, took one of the infielders or outfielders and mm-hmm. put him behind home plate.
That's right.
And so you only had seven players in fair territory.
That's right.
That later they made a rule that you got to have eight ball players in fair territory.
That's correct. Uh-huh. Yeah, I remember that because they used to take him and put him back there. I think Gus Trianis was the one that was more famous for catching Hart Wilhelm.
Oh, that's right. It was Gus Trianis.
Gus and I were in the military together for uh-huh. 2 years, and then when we were good friends, because we were 2 years together living together, uh-huh. and then when we both get out, he was with the Yankees out of Baltimore, uh-huh. we both traded for each other.
Oh, that's right. He was part of the other trade.
Yeah, and then Hoyt later on came mm-hmm. on over, maybe a year or so mm-hmm. after that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Gus probably still today probably leads the league in pass balls.
Well, that's right. You say, what am I going to do with this thing? Where's it going to go?
Uh-huh.
Put on the pinstripes in 55, mm-hmm. and of course, that continuation of that Yankee dynasty that certainly throughout your playing career. Before we turn to that, and the history is so rich that I'm embarrassed, I'm not sure where to begin. I'm sure that your mind is flooded with all kinds of memories and stories. So,
one thing I'd like to say before you go into that is that, that was probably about the scariest time of my life. Coming into Yankee Stadium. Well, going to spring training with them and knowing all of those guys. And I'm glad I had an opportunity to come from there and start in spring training, scratch for the ball club versus being traded in the middle of the year going over. Because they were very impressive. I mean, the Yankees were always winning every year,
mm-hmm.
all the names. And
mm-hmm.
even when they come on the ball field, the opposition always thought they looked 6 foot tall.
Mm-hmm.
But then I would get in spring training and found out they're just like you and I or anybody
else. They put their pants on one leg
right.
at a time.
And I found out they went out and partied just as much as the Baltimore
mm-hmm.
Orioles did or the Browns did. But the distinction between the two is that that when that game started, it was one unit as a team trying to win. when I played for the Baltimore Orioles, and give you an example, Clint Courtney was my catcher, and Clint is a very vocal guy. He came out of the Yankee organization, was straight over there. Remember, we went into Baltimore for the first opening game, and they were giving out prizes. And the ball players were all talking about, because some guys were going to play, some guys were going to play, so some could win, some couldn't win. So what they wanted to do is all of us to get together and all the prizes would take and turn into cash and divide amongst the whole team, which I thought was a novel idea. Clint got up in the middle of the court in the room. He says, "If you think if I win something, I'm going to share anything with you bums, you crazy, and sit down." Now, that was pretty much the kind of the feeling that you had with Baltimore. Where in New York, it was an entirely different feeling. It's just, over there, you had a mixture of a lot of ball players who came from a lot of different clubs, and they were just playing out the year, just trying to get another year in the big leagues, for another year for the pension, or whatever it may be. But New York, we all wanted to win. We wanted to be in the World Series, and you could just feel it and sense it.
That special chemistry.
Yeah, it was just a thing. And we didn't have any kangaroo courts or anything like that. But there was a certain amount of veterans on the ball club that would just say, "Come on, let's get going, kid. We want to be in the World Series, you know." And so you didn't mess around. And you pretty much kept your mouth shut over here. Or in the other club, everybody blah, 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 talked all the time. You respected the older guys on the ball club.
There was that kind of dignity that saying, "Hey, we're not going to mess around with one another's money."
But when you talk about ability, of course, you always had three or four or five of the Yankees had tremendous ability, Hall of Fame type things. But the balance of them were just average ball players that you had over at Baltimore, the same one. But it was just the chemistry then that made us go on and win the pennant.
You attribute a lot of that kind of thing. You know, if one person in his lifetime gets to experience that kind of feeling, whether on the ball field or at a university or what have you, you can say, "Thank the Lord I experienced that," because that was a rare occurrence. Not everybody gets to feel that.
No, you really don't. You know, and the business world is the same thing and everything, but to be part of something so magnificent that people highly thought about all over and who these people were now. See, Casey Stengel didn't give it to the club. That wasn't the manager. See, that's history, and it wasn't George Weiss. It wasn't none of that. It was the stadium. It was the awe, the records that this company did. And you had a tradition that you had to follow through on. And that's where it was really at. Because I've seen ball players come over that really did nothing in the other ball clubs and come over and do outstanding jobs with us. But they were put in a position that they would bear down a little bit and do it. So it's just a tradition of a ball club in the uniform and the clubhouse and the ballparks and how people make you feel good. Everybody patting you on the back and say, "Oh, you bums," and all kinds of things like that.
1955, the Yankees continued the World Series against the Brooklyn Dodgers. And of course, the Dodgers won their first World Series the first year you were with them.
Johnny Padres pitched the ball game.
That's right. And you were in that seventh game. Padres won that 2-0.
If he hadn't, Sandy Amers hadn't caught the ball, I would have been the winning pitcher of the seventh game of the 1955 World Series.
That's right.
I was the guy who was in there, and that was the bottom of the ninth inning.
That's right. That's when spectacular, you know, reaching into making that last stab at the ball there against the left field foul line, I remember correctly, and doubling up McDougal, who thought, "Hey, this is a clear hit," and the son of a gun, he's out at second base because he couldn't get back in time. Beginning pitcher of that last game was Tommy Byrne. I heard a story that of course I saw him in Kansas City, and he was wild. I mean, you know, the infielders, outfielders must have gotten tired getting ready to play because every batter had a 3-2 count on him. And I understand that old Tommy Byrne loved to telegraph and let the batter know what pitch was coming next.
Well, he was, Tommy and I played together with the St. Louis Browns. And then Tommy, he was with the Yankees, traded the Browns. Then he went back, went down to minor leagues, or maybe didn't go back to minor leagues, but he went back to the Yankees. And what he did, he lost his great fastball he used to have. When he lost his great fastball, then he had control. Now, he didn't have any better control, but when you throw slower than people like Lopez, I thought Lopez had the worst control of any pitcher I've ever seen in my life, but never walked nobody. But if you've seen the junk that Lopat threw, then you would want to swing it as a hitter. You'd swing at everything he threw. Well, Tommy Byrne wasn't as slow as Lopat, but when he came back, they would swing at the pitchers. You know, he would throw a pitch and they would hit it.
Mm-hmm.
To a hardball pitcher who was wild, you'd throw, they'd swing and miss. And you still ain't got nobody out. Or they'd foul, you still got to throw again. So it became a case of Tommy would make a pitch and they would hit it and get him out. Mm-hmm. So he was starting to pitch then. And, Tommy was a real character, you know. And then, of course, we played on the ball club together in 55 and 56. And but he's a real fun-loving guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he wasn't a carouser drinker, mm-hmm. but he would just always just bounce around mm-hmm. happy.
Yeah. Never knew that these ball players were getting tired, getting set after every pitch, and he probably thought, hey, this is just a fantastic game I'm pitching.
Yeah. Well, he would wind up, and in the middle of his wind-up, because he'd say, all right, he said, you've been standing up there long enough now. It's time for your swing. He had a favorite name for the pitch. Can't think of it right now. But here comes a fastball right down the middle of the plate. And he'd throw it and then stand and look at it. he did a lot of weird things. Like he called the Ephus, not the Ephus pitch. He had another name for it. That he'd wind up and throw the ball behind his back. And I actually watched him throw a ball like that in the major leagues.
It was in a
right,
game?
Yeah, in a major. It threw it right down the middle, and it was a strike. The umpire didn't know what to call it. Didn't know if it was illegal or
what. I guess Stingel could have a heart attack on that. He'd be pulling out the rest of his hair and see that kind of going on.
Casey was a fun-loving guy. A lot of people don't realize that. I mean, mm-hmm. he was tough and rough when he'd come out to argue with mm-hmm. umpires, and I think that was just part of his showmanship mm-hmm. that he used to do. But I recall, you know, a couple things that are real funny that I'll call, and you probably hadn't heard about them, but I remember I was playing a ball game in early in my career, 55 or 60, 56, mm-hmm. one of those 2 years, and Mickey was at the plate and he struck out. And so, man, he threw down the, like Mickey used to throw mm-hmm. the bus water cooler, he mm-hmm. threw down the bat, and the bat zoom, slid all the way in the dugout because Yankees were down below, and it ran over and just nicked Casey's leg. Mm-hmm. So as he came back in, then he throws his helmet and comes over, and Casey always says, hey, you young punk, you rookie, so you make sure when you strike out, you go put your equipment down. That costs money. And you go over and sit on that bench, and you think about what you've done. Next time, concentrate, and you won't strike out. Mickey didn't say nothing. Just looked at him. And so next inning, a couple innings later, Mickey goes up and he strikes out. Well, everybody on the bench is wondering what's going to happen. So Mickey walks over, and he's got his bat and his helmet. He walks over and puts a bat in a rack. He puts a hat down. He goes over to Stingel, and he gets about 2 inches from his nose. He says, ha, 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 I struck out. Stingel fell on the floor, laughed, rolled all over and everything else. And so he was the type of guy, he liked ball players to talk back to him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he really did. He respected a lot of them for people doing it. But
he didn't want yes guys.
No, he didn't want that. And it's like, I remember he was giving Yogi heck one day with calling the pitches. And and Yogi just came in, and he just couldn't stand him more. In the middle of the game, he just came right in. The game's going on. You know, he just walks over there, takes off his shin guard, throws his shin guards at him, his mask, and set everything you throw. He says, you're so damn smart, you go out and call the pitches. And that's right. Casey's laughing. You know, and then, of course, I guess one of the famous ones is Bobby Richardson. Because, Bobby was very religious. Never say a curse word or anything. And, of course, Casey could really tear loose. Yeah. It's a lot of ball players. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much the words. It was just a way of Steve Adores and,
pipe hitters and what have you.
Yeah, doing that. And one day he was really going to pour an ice cream, and then Bobby got up and walked to him and says, he said, why don't you wash out your mouth with soap? He was still mad.
I have read that you were a master at picking up the opposing hurlers' pitches, and that you helped a lot of your Yankee teammates, particularly Mantle, by whistling at them.
That's right.
Now, where'd you learn this trait?
Well,
that's not a common practice.
No, it's not. It's I guess when you're on a losing ball club like I was on, it's very easy to lose concentration on what's going on. You're losing all the time.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So when I was with the Browns, I used to sit and study pitchers and study catchers, just all the mannerism all the time. And I found out very quickly that everybody does, if you get out of the chair you're sitting in right now, you'll always move one leg first. It's just a habit with you, what you do.
Unconscious, that you're not aware of.
You're not aware of it. And so I started studying pitchers and a whole variety of different things. I started studying catchers. And all of a sudden I found out that when a guy would do this, he'd throw a certain pitch. So I picked that thing. And it kept my mind concentrated on what the game was going on all the time. And then when I came over to New York, I was over there, and Mickey always was striking out a lot. And he, one day we were sitting there, and I would say, that's a fastball, that's a curve. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm just calling the pitches. He said, can you do that all the time? I said, 80% of the guys in the big leagues, I could call the pitches. And so he said, well, tell me what you're doing. Let's get something going here. And so then we had a sign, and I would pick it. I'll give you several mannerisms that the guys would go through, but we had a sign. When the Yankees came into town, there were always big, huge crowds. Mm-hmm. So the roar of the crowd was always loud. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't give a voice sign to him, so I had to have a whistle sign.
How'd it go?
And a whistle sounds, well, I don't know if I can whistle loud enough, but, you know, it whistles real shrill and loud, and you can hear it. So we had a sign, and him and I worked it out, is that when he went to the plate, let's take an assumption that the pitcher has already thrown a pitch. Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to say it's a curveball. Mm-hmm. So we always assume the pitcher's always thrown a pitch, but he hadn't, but it was a curveball. Mm-hmm. So if I whistle, that changes the pitch. So it means if I whistle, that would change the curveball to fastball. Now, he's thrown a fastball now, so if I whistle again, it would be a curveball. If I whistle again, it would be a fastball. So nobody can catch us at doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing if I didn't whistle, it would be the same pitch as before.
Sure.
Sometimes I wouldn't whistle on a curveball, sometimes I whistle. But him and I knew what was going on. And nobody could catch what we were doing. Now, Mickey sometimes would lose his concentration.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he would do then is that he would take and rub his belly, meaning start all over again. So then I would have to start the system all over again. So we had that system go, so we could, it's like switch them up again.
Uh-huh.
And then if I miss a pitch, he'd hit his hat. But he'd say, keep on going, because even call.
Okay, so.
But even calling and missing a few pitches, Mickey said, he said, Bob, his head, he can't never figure out what the pitcher's going to throw.
Mm-hmm.
He said, your head, because you know pitching, you know everything else, you will always be 90% right. And so I just kept on. Sometime I'd miss a pitch.
Yeah.
It didn't bother him, because Mickey had the ability that he would wait for a certain pitch. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't just swing at everything.
Yes.
Because some guys you can't get sky and you can't call him signs. You know, he'd swing at everything you throw. And so I would keep on like that, and then if it was a wrong pitch, he would just give me a sign, he missed it.
Mm-hmm.
But then he would be sitting there waiting for a pitch. And when he got his pitch, he'd just kill you on it. And surprising that people thought you would think he would want fastballs. No, he wanted to know when the curveball was coming, when the changeup, because he was a good curveball and changeball. Mm-hmm. Anything slow speed, he'd just kill you.
Oh, yeah, just flatten that thing.
Oh, yeah. I remember a game we were playing against Jim Bunning in Detroit. I think Mickey put this in his book. Bunnings, and because I called everything Bunning through his whole career when he was in American League. I mean, Mickey knew everything that guy through his whole career. And I'll give you some big names that Mickey did too.
Mm-hmm.
And so he. We'd have our signs.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I wasn't whistling, he wouldn't do nothing. But Bunning, as soon as it whistles, if nobody on base, he would stop. And he would look at me, just stare me down.
And he knew what was going on.
Yeah, well, everybody in the league knew what I was doing.
Uh-huh.
But they didn't. They could never figure, nobody ever, baseball was, my career was over, they understand our signs. And Mickey stand up there, and then Bunning would call, stop his motion, call, pitch out, and come back, and knock Mickey down. Boom, he'd go down. Mickey would give me a sign, keep on calling.
Mm-hmm.
And he's getting mad. And he knocked Mickey down two times. And the third time, Mickey is now, he's burning up. He's really mad. Because he was hard to hit.
Yeah.
And then I called a sign, got it right, boom, he hit it clear out of the damn park. And we called Bunning Lizard. And he runs around the bases, I got you this time, you old lizard. Going all right. And Bunning, when you look at Bunning's looking at me the whole time.
He's sore at you than he is a mantle.
Oh, yeah, very. An early win, we used to kill early win. Just early win.
He was a competitor too.
Yeah, he was a competitor, but he was perfectious. Even when early in our good friends today, and he lives right up the road here, and I used to tell him that, you know, when he was through and I was through, I said, "Call you, no, you did." I said, "I know you ain't going to believe it, but I'll tell you this: as you go see McDougal was one.
Mm-hmm.
See, now early I didn't call his signs because he was so obvious what he's doing. I would tell the hitters, and they knew themselves." All we want an early win to do was get somebody on base because he was Mr. Perfectionist. I mean, if he was going to throw a knuckleball, he'd bring his hands up and his hands would always go below his chin. perfect. I mean, there it was. Now, if you was use the chin as a point, anything mm-hmm. below that is going to be a knuckleball. All right. Now, anything above from the chin to the forehead here, when he's bringing the glove in, it's mm-hmm. real obvious when you hit her, mm-hmm. is a curveball. Now, when he goes over the forehead up here, it's a fastball. I mean, it's so obvious. And so
he didn't, but didn't Cleveland Matt or Boudreaux never catch that?
A lot of people don't understand that, don't see what's going on. But that was.
I mean, that's telegraphing, very simple.
Yeah, but simple. But if nobody knows,
notice it, that it's complex.
It takes somebody to understand. Yeah. So we would do that all the time. And when he was going to throw a changeup, he would go all the way behind his head, like this. Uh-huh. So we knew everything he was going to throw. And so McDougal must have hit 900 against a guy in the big leagues, and Mickey would kill him. Then they had a guy by the name of Connie Johnson. If you remember him, he was a screwball pitcher, big, tall, mm-hmm. black fella. Mm-hmm. And Connie pitched for Clive Ball Club. Mm-hmm. Richards had him. But when he was standing on the mound, he was a screwball pitcher. Mm-hmm. And he was on the right-hand side of the mound with his foot. That's where he'd throw the fastball and curveball. But if he was going to throw a screwball, he'd move over on the other side of the mound. And Mickey just loved to hit his screwball because Mickey was hitting him left-handed. And that's all he wanted to throw. So Mickey would watch that, and I didn't have to tell him that. Uh-huh. I mean, there was no sign given.
A
lot of the signs that I gave to Mickey was things that he could do himself.
That's right.
And so that there was no communication between us.
No whistling or anything like that. It would just say, watch the feet, watch the hands on the head or whatever.
I remember Al Lopez was a manager then at the White Sox, and Johnson was on the mound pitching, and the bases were loaded, and we were about one or two runs down or something mm-hmm. like that. And it was late in the game, and Mickey was a hitter. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, my God, don't take him out. Mickey, I knew Mickey's praying, please leave him in. Please leave him in. So they had a conference, and they left him on the mound. The first pitch he threw was a screwball. Mickey hit it on the roof in Kennedy Ballpark. He won the ball game. You know? But nobody knew anything because we wouldn't tell nobody. I wouldn't even tell a lot of the players on the Yankees that. I'd only tell certain ones because what happens if you tell everybody, then the
word's going to get out.
They've got to get a few beers with it or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of Billy Pierce. We call every pitch that Billy mm-hmm. Pierce threw. And there's a whole slew of these guys I can give you. Mm-hmm. Mickey McDermott, when he was with Boston, we had all of his signs. He came with the Yankees, mm-hmm. and I showed Mickey what he was doing. But Mickey was such a, I guess, stupid or what do you want to call it. I don't know. I don't think he was stupid. Here, mm-hmm. but he would just some things.
He was hot-headed.
And he never changed. He kept mm-hmm. on going. And then when they traded him away, he'd get on the mound pitch. He says he'd be wind up. He was like Tommy Burns. And he'd say, I'm throwing a fastball. You don't have to call the sign. So there was a lot of things like that.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of this. Many, many different ways. I had one guy. Here's one I'll tell you. This is a real strange one. I had a guy by the name of Howie Kitt. Was a left-hand pitcher mm-hmm. for the Yankees. Didn't stay around long, mm-hmm. but he was about 6'4", big 14-size foot. And when he was pitching, and when you throw a curveball, you have to land on your toe because you shorten your stride to mm-hmm. give you more forward, coming forward. Mm-hmm. And so he'd land on his toe, you wouldn't hear nothing. And when he's going to throw a fastball, you'd reach down, stretch out, and his big foot would go pow, pow. And I tell the guy, I says, all you got to do is just listen.
What's coming.
You wouldn't hear the big pow because he was big, and his uh-huh. body would finish before the. I said, here comes a fastball. I mean, that's all I have to do. And you could call these signs with your eyes closed.
You're one of the rare persons that ever developed something like this. Do you ever think about coaching after you do that?
I did some coaching. I come back to Paul Richmond. But there are a lot of guys, majority of them will steal a sign about how the pitcher holds the ball. Mm-hmm. All right? I could do those things, whether you hold it with the seams, mm-hmm. across the seams. But mine was more in bending wrists, don't bend the wrists. Coming out of the glove, how you come out of the glove, because if you're going to throw a curveball, your hands, Whitey Ford, I could call all his pitches. He'd come out like this, and mm-hmm. I go, it's a breaking ball, because your wrist has to be in that position to throw a curveball. Mm-hmm. A fastball would be in this position, so you would see those things. And I used to, Whitey didn't know it, but I told him later on, and he said, please don't tell nobody when I was on the ball club, mm-hmm. but I knew he called all of his signs. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, him and Yogi, that was a closely kept secret, and they didn't think, not even the coach knew that, not even Stingle, nobody knew that.
That Whitey called his own
pitches?
Called
his own pitches, yeah. And Whitey used to stand on, and he would bend over, and if he bent over and shook his glove, that was going to be a fastball. If he stood up, then that was going to be a curveball. And he had shaken the glove with bending over or standing up was what pitches he was going to throw, and he would tell Yogi the Yogi. And I knew that, and I said, Whitey, I said, you know, I haven't watched you. We've been together, teammates, a couple of years. I says, you call all your pitchers for Yogi all the time, don't you? He looked at me and he said, God, don't tell nobody that. I said, why? You're my teammate. I ain't going to tell.
No.
I used to, the Yankees were ones that let me use what I was doing. Because I remember
one time. You're going to have to get permission from Casey on something like that.
Right. When I was a starting pitcher, I was on a bench. But you know, when you later on, you go from, because Casey switched, I'd be down the bullpen. But when I was in the bullpen, that's when our pitcher was pitching. But when we came to play, they made me come all the way into the tunnel, come up the clubhouse and dugout, and sit there and call the pitches. Mickey refused to have me be down in the
he wanted you there in the dugout.
Out there to call signs for him. I was on the disabled list one time with a broken finger. And so they made me, I was on the disabled list, so I couldn't be on the bench.
That's right.
So they got box seats for me to sit right next to the dugout. Yeah. And call him from the stands for Mickey as we was on the road trips and home games. I did that for him. And I used to go in to the TV room because now TV came. And I was in my glory when I got a TV set. Mm-hmm. So I'd have him put a camera right on the pitcher. And I'd study him for an inning and real quick. And then I'd have what I wanted. Then I'd go back out. And I'd start calling the signs out there.
Amazing. I'd like to talk about your pitching. Mm-hmm. You know, those are fascinating stories. But... you had that, you had a fastball. You were called Bullet Bob.
Right.
Up in the 90 per hour right. Scale when there weren't that many pitchers throwing that. You know, right. Surely Bob Lemon and Bob Feller and a few others. But you went into a no-wind-up delivery to improve your control because you did walk a lot of guys as well as strike them out.
Mm-hmm.
Did you think of that change yourself, or did someone point that out to you?
Yeah, I'll tell you when it started taking place. Don Larson and I, in 1956, at the end of the season, Don Larson, they were stealing his signs, and Jim Turner was a pitching coach.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, so he started, not in the game, but working on a sideline, and then Turner comes and he says, look, why don't you do the same thing as Don is? Don's doing it to hide it. Why don't you be a little bit more deliberate and get out of this, and I think it might help you control.
Mm-hmm.
So Don and I both practiced it together at the same time. And I think it's Turner was upon Turner's suggestion, and Don worked one way, I worked one way. And then in Boston, right before the 56 World Series, and we're warming up for the 56 World Series, we both pitched together in the same game, and we both used it for the first time. And, of course, everybody thought, oh, how stupid it was and everything else. And then we went in the World Series, and he pitched the perfect game.
With that same kind of delivery.
Same delivery. That's when we just brought it in. And then I pitched the very next day and got beat 1-0 in 10 innings. Probably pitched the best game in my whole Major League career, and I gave up about 3 or 4 hits. And I should have had a no-hitter the next day, but Slaughter lost three of the balls and misjudged three of the balls. And McDougal, they got a hit or something off of him. But and so we started using it from them.
And then it became a kind of a fad. All the pitchers started imitating it?
Today, that's all pitchers, out of no windups. See, because once they get out of the hit, see, it was a change in baseball, dramatic change. And they all said, well, you're not going to get any power. I said, well, wait a minute. Analyze the windup, and if you wind it, when your hands are going down this way, you're not throwing the ball that way. So you don't get ready to throw a ball to the plate until your hands drop down in this position. Now it's coming in that type of an arc. And all we did was start from here, drop the ball down in the arc, and go right on with it. And then it made it easy because you perfected a compacter windup, and you couldn't get as much trouble. Some guys would rock and roll and do all, and they'd get all out of sync. Their feet would hit sooner. And so when Don did and I did that, I must have cut 60 baseball balls off of my record just instantly like that overnight.
And, of course, a lot of pitchers, they, you know, 33 years later are still doing it. 35 years later are still doing that.
Well, if you watch the big leagues now, I would venture to say 85% of the guys in the big leagues pitch with a no-windup today, a variety of different forms. They stand there and take the signs. Watch Clements. You see what Clements does. You know, he stands there looking through his glove and set his hands at his sides like we used to do all the big pump, the Warren Spahn. Some guys could do that. But Balcom they're right here, and they might come up a little bit and then swing around. But Balcom are just standing here, just drop right down.
So cut down a lot of excess body motion to keep your body in sync.
Right, that's right. Pitchers had better control with men on base than they did with men not on base. It's hard to understand that, but you see a lot of the relievers now. None of them pitch from a windup. They all pitch from a stretch completely. And what is a stretch? I mean, you're standing here, boom, drop it down and throw.
That's what you did with men on bases when I was growing up.
That's right. So so it, common sense tells you, you can throw harder and longer this way, and you don't get out of sync all the time. So it really worked out real well, and majority of all the managers, now that's why you have a little bit better. If you look at the overall base on balls today, I think you'd see it's better than it was during a certain period of time. And I think that's got one of the major changes. That's one of the major reasons for all that.
So you and Don Larson were pioneers in just that basic change.
Right. And we got a lot of criticism about that. And all he did was throw a perfect game. And,
that's right.
And then I had a great game after.
Correct. And, of course, won the World Series after the Dodgers won it the year before.
Right.
And I guess that was the last year that the Brooklyn was in town.
Right. Then they went out to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm.
I must get into pitching, but some thoughts about, you know, the old Ebbets Field and, you know, the Subway Series. I guess I'm pausing because I'm not sure, you know, there's so many stories been written about, you know, that period of baseball history. Are there some thoughts that you have that are not commonplace? There's so much of a lore of history that you recall of those great series between Brooklyn and New York, that maybe the aura of playing in Ebbets Field, you know, the old bandbox.
Well, you know, it's... There's nothing like a Dodger fan during those days. You know, I recall we all go to Yankee Stadium, and they call it Subway Series, but that was for the fans. It was not for for the ball players.
Yeah.
And we all get in a bus. Some of the guys would go over on their own, get there earlier, then take the bus from Yankee Stadium, and we'd go on over there. And I remember they were just, I mean, these are teenagers and some adults. You know, they're all lined up, and they had to have police to from a door of our bus so we go inside. No, the people would be there. Then they didn't have ball pens too much. They had ink pens. And they'd flick ink on you, and they'd do everything else. I mean, they were really rabid fans in that sense. And then when the ball game's gone, even practice, I mean, they're on you all the time. They didn't. You go out and hitting. Normally, today you go to the ballpark and hear them hit, and nobody says nothing. But those days, I mean, they were making as much noise during batting practice and infield as you had when the game was
going. A lot of catcalling.
Oh, yeah. I mean, heckling you, bum, you know, and they called you. Not dirty names, but just the slang of that era that they would use, and everything, you know.
Returning to pitching, there's an old thing that that a pitcher sets his own pace, but the catcher, except I guess for Whitey Ford, calls the game. Did you have much involved in making your own pitching selections, or did you leave that up to Barra and others to call the pitches?
Well, what we had is we always had it before every game. We would talk. We had a clubhouse meeting to talk about how you were going to pitch that ball game that day, so the defense would know where to play, what you're going to do. But the actual game itself, when you're out there pitching, you got different styles of pitchers. The majority of the pitching is such a highly emotional thing when you're out there, and there are some pitchers who think. And there are some pitchers who don't think.
You mean that one-on-one confrontation with the batter? Is that what you mean by emotional?
Well, so much. Well, emotionally that they're in la-la land, okay? I mean, it's hey, what am I doing out here? You know, and they're not thinking about what they're doing. So you have to have a good catcher that has a plan to call pitches.
Okay.
And that type of situations, majority of the pitchers don't call, very few of the pitchers. It's done by management before we start the game and how to play. And Yogi was good at calling signs. I probably was a little bit like that in the beginning when I first came over, but later on, I'm the one that's got to throw the pitch. And then Yogi and I were pretty much in sync together all the time. I wouldn't shake him off a lot of times, but sometimes I would. But I'm the one that's got to throw the pitch. So Yogi wouldn't argue with me, because even if it was contrary to how I was going to pitch a guy, what's the sense of him having me throw a pitch that he wants me to throw that I don't want to throw? It's disaster.
Yeah, that's right.
So we kind of work things out together. We never had any confrontation, you know, that calling the wrong signs, or I didn't criticize him because he called the wrong signs. Because I'm going to throw it. I'm not forced to throw that pitch.
That's right. You don't like it. You don't feel comfortable with
it.
You see something in the batter. Hey.
Well, it's just that I feel better doing a certain thing.
Pitching around is kind of a defensive weapon. You know, don't give the guy anything good to hit, but don't walk him. Are there some batters that you faced in that you had to do a lot of pitching around that were? Of course, you know, you can get the Ted Williams and others, but just had good eyes and that you really had to be extra careful with, aside from, of course, the guys that could blast the home run and the Ted Williams?
Yeah, there were a lot of guys. That's why the management was sometimes difficult. We didn't keep exact records as they do today. That today you can have records of when a guy, what pitch he threw, where did he hit it, and you get all of because of the cheap charts, and we didn't keep all that stuff. But I knew in my heart who would hit me the most. It's like you take a guy like Al Kaline. Al Kaline, I don't know. I don't know what his records. I mean, if anybody could dig up that information, but Al Kaline probably hit maybe 220 against me. But I never had any problem getting him out. So he was one guy that I knew how to pitch him. I didn't care if I went in. He was in the hottest streak in the world. There's no way he could hit me. And you had a Bob Allison, who was a pretty good ball player in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Those guys, they just couldn't hit me. There was just no way in their hearts they could hit me. And Bob Allison, I used to pitch him one basic pattern, and all I threw three pitches every time he came to the plate. I would throw a curveball in the dirt, then I'd miss with another curveball, and he would say, oh, here comes a fastball. Then I would throw a high slider. Now, you'd say that's a bad pitch. I'd throw a high slider right out here, and, man, he could see a thing, and he'd hit the nice, softest fly balls to center field and right field. And that's it. Every day he'd go 0 for 4 against me. Four fly balls right to the center field. And he said, I'll get you someday. And never did he ever understand how I was pitching. Well, I knew that because he wasn't, if he did, he would have known what I was doing. But never, but my whole career, that's how I pitched against him. Al Kaline, it just didn't make no difference with Al Kaline. He just couldn't hit me. It is just, I could throw.
Psychologically, just that he.
I don't know what, maybe it was me. Maybe I had a feeling. I said, Al, I mean, there ain't no way you can hit me. And anything I throw, you can't hit me. Because I used to do a lot of that and talking to yourself. I'd have a hitter up there. It's a joke. You know, I would do this mentally. It's a joke. What are you up here? I can throw the ball down the middle of the plate, and you can't touch it. And I throw the ball down the middle of the plate, boom, pop it up, there it goes. And that's where you got to psych yourself up. And it's just, I don't know, it's I believe in that real strong.
A kind of positive thinking reinforcement saying, forget about what happened the batter before. I know I got...
You know, I would pitch around certain guys, Rosens during those days. I would not try to put myself in a position where he would beat me a ball game. I'd never let Ted Williams beat me a ball game, you know, try to pitch around him. And Nellie Fox was probably the toughest ball player I ever had to get out. He was probably one of my closest friends, and because we were both on bowling lanes, and we used to bowl against each other and everything. And the guy would get on base. You know, I'll tell you a little funny story, and Yogi will tell you if you ever see him. But we're playing in Chicago, and this guy would hit two home runs a year. He'd hit one or two of them off of me. On base, 900% against me. I mean, he'd do every bunt, he'd do everything. And there's no way I could get, I'd walk, he'd do everything. So I'm in Chicago, I'm pitching a ball game, and he's standing to play, you know, big chaw to back, choking up on the bat a little bit, scrunched down. And I throw a pitch, and he had the big baggy uniform. So I throw a little pitch, he puts his arm out, takes the shirt, and he goes to first base. And I was furious, missing Scott. And I walked over to the first base line with him, and we walked in the first base. I just got to remember, he's a good friend of mine now. I said, you like to get hit? And he looked at me, wouldn't say nothing. I kept walking. I said, you like to get hit? And he still wouldn't say nothing. And we're walking to first base together. Yogi's coming up behind. He thinks I'm going to fight him. And we get to first base, and he touched first base. I said, Nellie, I'm pointing at him. I said, if you like to get hit, I promise you one thing, I'm going to hit you. And Ed Runge's the umpire. He's there. And he grabs hold of my arm, and Yogi's trying to get me away. And I'd walk back. And Runge says, he said, Bob, I don't blame you. I'd hit him, too. Yogi goes back, and he sits down. And we get side out. We come in the dugout, and I'm over to the water cooler getting a drink of water. He said, are you serious? You're going to hit him? I said, Yogi, I've never been more serious in my life. He goes, ah. So the game goes along, sixth or seventh inning. We're beating 5 or 6 to nothing. Up comes Nellie Fox, two out, nobody on base. So Yogi gets down. Of course, he remembers. He sits down, his crouch, and he puts down two fingers, which means curveball. He puts down again. I said, nope. Puts down third. Nope. Now, Nellie knows what's going on. Yogi stands up. Nobody on base. And he backs up. Because he knows how to drill. And he don't want him to part. So he stands. He puts up one finger. Backs, and I rear. And I rear back and let the thing. And I was really bringing the ball really good. And I throw. When you're going to hit somebody, you throw for the hip.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, you throw for the hip because you can't move the middle part of your body. We don't throw people up here.
No,
that's just a brush back to keep you alive. Or you don't throw at their legs. You're not. It's impossible. But the hip, you can't get out of the way. And so I ran back, and I was bringing the ball real good that day. And I threw it right for his hip, And boy, he turns his back like this, and I hit him right in the middle of the back. Boom! Down he goes. He swallows his tobacco. And he's laid out. And I won't look at him. I won't look at the Bilbeck scoreboard there. Our coaches, his coach, I thought he'd kill him. I won't look at him. So he finally gets up and brushes himself, and he goes first base. He says, "Bob, I don't want to get hit no more." From that rest of our career, never did he ever let any pitch come close to him. I said, "You're not going to get on base on me that way."
I tell you, that backup must have been tasting pretty terrible going down the old gut. Ugh.
We were out that night together, and he pulled up his shirt. And he said, "Look at here. You can see the seams of the ball." I said, "Well, hell," I said, "you want to get hit, I'll hit you." So what more can I do?
That wouldn't go on today, though. Players' Union be after you, Bob.
I'd be banned from baseball.
That's right.
And all kinds.
See, you'd be getting nasty letters from the Players' Union.
Sure. Everything you could think about, you know. But it was no intention to kill him. I'm just going to let him know.
Keep him honest.
Yeah, keep him honest. And we used to do that. Rizzuto would bunt. When Rizzuto would bunt against any major league club, they'd knock him down three times. Mm-hmm. All the time. I mean, just boom, down you go. Boom, down you go.
A little bit of chin music.
Umpires knew what was going on. That's how we played baseball. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody was going to kill anybody. No. But today, my gosh, a pitch come inside, they want to fight.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to pitch in. There's four places that play. I mean, inside and outside, as well as up and down.
Mm-hmm. And that was your property.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you can do what you want. I mean, you want to crowd the plate? Fine, crowd the plate. I mean, whatever you want to do, but I'm still going to pitch inside. Mm-hmm. I'm going to play your game.
They say that pitching has three virtues, velocity, movement, and location.
Right. It's true.
What was most important to you?
Oh, you know, being...
Given your nickname.
Bullet Bob, yeah. You know, I love to strike guys out. And when I threw a fastball, I wasn't looking for position. I was looking for speed and movement of the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Movement more than anything else. Pitching today has come a long way. When I came up the big leagues, you had to have a changeup, you had to have a curveball, and you had to have a fastball. But mainly you had to have a curveball. Curveball is the most difficult pitch of all pitches to throw. Today, a modern-day pitcher today...
Because of the wear and tear on the elbow?
No, it's because most people can't hit the curveball, breaking ball.
Yeah,
so you had to perfect that. I don't care how good you were with any other pitchers. And I think I've seen more guys spend a lifetime career in the minor leagues because the pitching coaches and the philosophy of baseball was so wrong. And then they changed all of that. I think Paul Richards changed it more than anybody I know. Is that then they came up with a little bit of slider. Now, everybody threw, some guys threw sliders now, but they really perfected the slider, and they perfected a little bit of the sinker. And then the kids were coming up with strong arms at a much younger age, a Dean Chance, for example, who couldn't throw a curveball to save his soul, but he had a great slider and a great sinker, and that's all you did. Then couldn't throw a changeup, but that's all you had to throw, because you had one pitch going this way, one going this way, both pitches down, which are next to impossible to hit. A slider down and a sinker down. Mm-hmm. Sinker is probably the hardest pitch of them all. Because it's going down all the time, and it's with speed of your fastball. And then the slider would be a little bit off speed of the fastball, so you could use them. So modern day pitchers today don't throw curveballs much. Very rarely do they throw curveballs. It's mostly fastballs and the sinkers.
Mm-hmm.
And you have those pitches easy to control. A slider is easier to control than a fastball. A slider is easier to control, much easier than a curveball. And so now that you get better control, you throw those pitches perfected, you're pitching down low. So pitching all of a sudden took another big leap forward. And so I knew a lot of guys that should have been in the big leagues a long time, great arms, but they weren't.
They weren't. But that gets into the strike zone. That meant redefining the strike zone. Now, when I was a kid, the letters and the kneecaps.
Right, armpits, underneath the armpits and kneecaps. That was the strike zone.
Not anymore.
Oh, no. It's
more like the belt buckle down by your ankles.
That's right. It's a belt buckle.
But the rule still says armpits and kneecaps.
That's right. That's right.
You think that's because of what has happened in the pitch?
The style of pitching and the mark of the pitching being in one way, and the umpires go along with it.
Of the umpires that called you, which ones do you remember as the most consistent? I'm not saying that you agreed with their call.
Ed Runge was the best. He was a pitcher's umpire.
How's that?
Well, he wanted the game to go forward. He wanted guys to swing the bat. So he called more strikes. But everybody knew Ed Runge. I mean, Ed Runge's strike zone was that much outside on his side of the plate. Mm-hmm. And he made the game go faster.
Mm-hmm.
And made the guys swing the bat. And so these guys just stand there and take and take and take and take. And so we had long games. Everybody's moaning and groaning about it. They don't moan and groan about long games today, but years ago they did. And so that was where he was at. I mean, that's where his strike zone was at.
So his strike zone on inside and outside was about a 1.5 inch.
1 to 2 inches
outside or inside?
Yeah, he was. But he was consistent. Hitters knew that. He knew that. And it used to take me, and I don't think, I probably didn't lose maybe one or two games in my whole, well, maybe one or two games, maybe one, my whole career with him behind the plate. They used to specifically set me up so that he was my umpire. If he was in the crew, they figure out the schedule so that he would be behind the plate. And I pitched 25 shutouts in the big leagues, 24, 25, which is a lot of shutouts.
Mm-hmm.
And of those shutouts, I'll bet you 12 of them he umpired behind home plate.
Hmm.
I had the confidence in him. And I would still walk guys, but that he, when he was back there, I was very confident. I take a guy like Ed Hurley. Ed Hurley, who died, you know, a nice guy, but he was a grudge umpire. It didn't make any difference. He would get mad at you, and your whole career was at it. I remember pitching a ball game, and he didn't like me for some reason. I don't know why he didn't like me, because I wasn't an umpire baiter or anything like that. But I was pitching a ball game in Chicago, and I must have threw six pitches right down the middle of the plate. Right down the middle of the plate. Ball, 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 ball. And he had to throw Stengel out of the game. Stengel had to finally take me out of the ball game. And I don't care what I threw, it was going to be a ball. It didn't make no difference.
When you pitched at Yankee Stadium, you always had to deal with the shadows. How did that affect you as a pitcher?
Well, as a pitcher, it was wonderful because it made it tough on the ball players. Because especially in the spring of the year and the fall of the year, when you get those shadows coming in, when the sun's changed a little bit, and when you're in the bright sun, you're looking out in the bright sun, squinting, then the ball's going to come in the shadows.
The shadows there at that split second.
It's still there.
So you
today.
Use that a lot too, as a kind of.
I didn't think about it as pitching the ball game. Because I remember Joe Collins one time, I was pitching the ball game I pitched in Brooklyn. I got beat 1-0 in 10 innings. Collins said to me, "So Bob, just hold them till the shadows get here and we got you."